You're listening to SBS On The Money with Ricardo Gonçalves.
Coming up on the SBS On The Money Markets podcast, APRA tightens lending rules for risky investors, emerging interest rate calls, they're changing, and a focus on the tech sector. All of that and more next. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the SBS On The Money podcast for this Thursday, the 27th of November, 2025. It's a day where the Australian share market rose, only just up by 0.1% on the S&P ASX 200. We'll have the details with Hugh Lamb from Beta Shares. He'll tell us more about the day's market action, along with what he's telling his clients. But first, to some news out of the banking and lending industry. While APRA, the banking regulator, says overall bank lending standards remain sound, it's noticed a pickup in some riskier lending as interest rates fall and house prices surge. It comes as a number of new loans climbed, according to the ABS a few weeks ago, especially for investors, which soared to record levels. And the most recent APRA stat shows total new high-risk mortgage lending, so that's for people borrowing at least six times their gross annual income, well, that rose to 5.5% in the June quarter from 5% a year ago. That is still low, but is expected to increase as competition heats up, and some banks do already lend more than that. So the regulator is applying the handbrake preemptively. So from February the 1st, banks and lenders will only be allowed to lend up to 20% of their new mortgage lending to this high-risk group, although those borrowing to build or buy a new home will be excluded. That's been welcomed by the Banking Association, which says the best way to address housing affordability is to boost supply. So to find out more about this initiative, I spoke with Nathan Zaya from Morningstar. Nathan, why do you think APRA is applying these limits, and do you think there is a cause for concern?
Well, I don't think at this stage there is. I think APRA is just mindful that if we have an increase in new highly leveraged borrowers at a point in the cycle where, you know, house prices are high and household indebtedness is already high, that it could, one, push up house prices even further, and it just exposes more people to financial stress if their circumstances change. So historical data suggests that people that have higher debt to income, they're more likely to face stress. And that's just because they don't have as much of a headroom to cope with, you know, changes to income. So say you get less hours of work, or changes to expenses because interest rates went up or inflation went up, or you might have an unexpected thing like your car breaks down. So they're just higher risk borrowers on average. So that's why, you know, APRA is just mindful that they don't want to see too much growth in that bucket. And there's also macroeconomic risks. You know, those borrowers that cop a hit to income or expenses, they need to cut back on a consumption even more, which then reverberates throughout the economy. But I mean, it is the reason I say it's not reason to be concerned, because it is just one metric. You know, the income and the wealth, like how much the owning cash and property outside of that, can also influence how risky that borrower is as well.
So what are the implications for borrowers?
Yeah, I mean, firstly, it looks like at this stage, it'll be the fringe borrower that's affected anyway, because most of the banks won't be, you know, growing as fast as this speed limit is anyway. So they still have a lot of capacity to service those borrowers where, yes, it might look like a high debt to income, but the borrower is financially, you know, well off and can, you know, support it and has means to keep paying that loan if things change. So yeah, I don't necessarily think that there's going to be like a direct change. I mean, overall, it might have a modest impact on credit growth. You know, if a bank all of a sudden can't grow their loan book as fast as they wanted to, then maybe they'll be a little bit more selective as well in terms of, okay, maybe we'll charge a bit of a higher interest rate for these higher debt-to-income loans, or we'll just be more selective and target those wealthier borrowers in that category.
What about government policy and housing supply? Because won't this impact some first home buyers using the government's 5% deposit scheme who borrow a significant amount of money to borrow the property purchase price. Because at the same time, I think this this new rule exempts new properties or the construction of new properties, right?
Yeah, I mean, again, the thing to point out is that the most recent data we have, around 5.5% of new lending was in this high DTI bucket. So what they've said is we don't want to see that go over 20%, and it's separate between investor and owner occ. So this government scheme, you'd think it's more the owner occ category. So there still is, you know, a lot of headroom there anyway that the banks can still not only keep, you know, maintain the amount of loans they had been writing, but they can still even grow it. So this isn't like where we had speed limits put in place before, when where it was about, you know, let's rein it in. This is just APRA's, you know, mindful that this could become a risk, and they don't want to see banks getting ahead of themselves. So I don't think this limit is going to all of a sudden mean, you know, someone that had access to that grant now fails to get a loan because the bank's like, no, sorry, the DTI is too high. So there still is room for that on the bank's balance sheet. I mean, and maybe it goes in their way, in their favor as well. Maybe this slows investor appetite, and, well, not just appetite, but their actual ability. And maybe that helps affordability. If you have, you know, less investors competing against those first home buyers, maybe it just takes, you know, some of the extra pressure that would have come through on house prices away.
Okay, that's Nathan Zaya there from Morningstar. Let's take a look at the Australian share market now, with the S&P ASX 200 open strongly, but the market really lost some ground throughout the session, ending in positive territory only just because it was in the red about an hour before the close. The S&P ASX 200 at 8,617, that's a rise of 0.1%. 9 of 11 sectors ended higher. The best performing included information technology, followed by healthcare and consumer discretionary, although energy stocks fell, so they're oil-related companies. The best performer today, HMC Capital, up by around about 10%. GQG Partners and Digico Infrastructure doing well, along with WiseTech, another tech company there doing well today, up 6.5%. Losers include QBE Insurance. Investors didn't like an update from the company relating to slower premium growth there. Shares down by about 3.7%. Babcor off by 3.8%. Harvey Norman losing 4%. The worst performer on the 200, though, was DroneShield. Shares down by 7.8%. For a wrap on the day's market action, I spoke with Hugh Lamb from BetaShares. Hugh, the ASX is up today. What's driving investor sentiment at the moment?
Yeah, thanks very much, Ricardo. The ASX is really following developments from what's happening in the US. We've had a repricing of rate cut expectations. That means the probability of a rate cut in the December meeting is looking more likely. And that has supported particularly our local technology sector. So names like Xero and Life360 have done quite well. But more broadly, what we've seen with that repricing of rate cuts, that has weighed on the US dollar. And then that tends to be quite supportive of things like gold. So spot gold prices have risen, and that's also supported local gold miners as well, such as Newmont. So that's all in all sort of, you know, driving up the ASX. We've had a sort of renewed sense of risk on sentiment in recent days following that.
Okay, we should make clear you are referring to US interest rates, so there's optimism going there. But what about market pricing for local Australian interest rates? Because yesterday, stronger than expected inflation number, to what extent did that take a rate cut off the table? And are we really looking at the potential for the next move in interest rates here to be up?
It's a really great question, Ricardo. We actually have seen quite a divergence in interest rates forecast between the US and Australia. So as you mentioned, that stronger than expected inflation print that we saw yesterday has almost taken rate cuts off the tables in 2025. In fact, you know, when we look towards 2026, there is a small chance of a probability of a rate hike. And so now the probability of the balance between a rate cut and a rate hike looks a little bit more balanced. And, you know, what we'll have to see here for any rate cuts to materialize is, of course, any sort of deterioration in the labor market or if growth slows materially. But for now, inflation does look a little bit sticky. But what that means is that that tends to be quite supportive for the Australian dollar relative to the US interest rate. So that can be quite conducive for something like currency hedging a portion of your global equities portfolio. But also, if you're an Aussie traveler and you like to travel overseas, an uptick in the Australian dollar versus the US dollar can also put a little bit more money in your pocket.
Okay, you mentioned tech stocks doing well overseas and here. Do you believe in the tech stock story at the moment? Investors continue to flock into AI. We did see quite a large correction earlier a few weeks ago when we thought there were these overvaluation concerns, a lot of it linked to the potential for US interest rates to stay high for longer, which seems to have reversed over the past few days.
Yeah, look, we're still very constructive on the whole US tech complex and also the broader AI supply chain. The talks about an AI bubble, I think, is warranted and can be a healthy discussion. But what we've actually seen is that corporate earnings in the most recent quarter in the US have been extremely strong. If we look at companies within the NASDAQ 100, they've actually grown their earnings by a rate of 23% year over year. So that's an outstanding amount. And so that means that the rise in equity markets that we've seen from the past 3 years when ChatGPT was launched, that's really been backed by strong fundamentals. But more broadly, we're seeing strong, spending in CapEx. Again, that should filtrate to the rest of the tech ecosystem. And what we've seen between NVIDIA and Google has caused some concern that NVIDIA may lose some of its market share in the GPU space. But if anything, I think that competitive force, that nature, will provide marginal benefits for end consumers, whether that's across enterprise or individuals. They can access leading-edge technologies, and hopefully, we'll see an uptick in adoption rates in AI. So that's where we sit in technology.
Any company news you're following today on the market?
In terms of company news, I think we're looking towards any development in sort of the neo cloud. So these are companies such as CoreWeave, and if there's been any sort of deterioration with their names, that can be a leading indicator of weakness within the tech space. So far, we haven't seen that yet. But also, what we've seen in the US is a few other technology names report, such as Dell and HP. We've seen a bit of divergence between the results, but Dell did quite well because they revised guidance upwards on the back of AI-related revenue growth. But we saw HP take a hit just because they announced a round of layoffs. So that's what we're looking at from a company's perspective.
And finally, what are you telling your clients right now, and where do you see the opportunities for investors?
Just with the whole AI bubble and concerns around valuations, we're telling our investors and clients to remain diversified and to take a long-term view to investing. I think that there are opportunities within tech, as I mentioned, owning something like an ETF that tracks the NASDAQ 100 can be a great way to maintain a diversified exposure to some of the most innovative companies in the world, including the Magnificent Seven companies. But for those investors who are a little bit concerned about what's happening in the US, they can seek exposures that does not include the US. So ex-US exposures can also be a great tool for investors to diversify geographically. Finally, I think another thing that we're talking about with clients is in regards to Japan as a region. That region is looking incredibly constructive with the newly elected president and prime minister, Takaichi. She is very pro fiscal and supportive of the local stock market. We've seen the topics take a bid since she was elected. But also, if we continue to see strong corporate governance reforms, any resolution in global trade tensions as well, that should be quite constructive for local exporters in the Japanese economy. So those are three things we're talking to our clients right now.
Chu Lam there from BetaShares, and he wraps the podcast for this Thursday. Don't forget, if you enjoy it, to give it a rating or review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Click that subscribe button, and I'll see you tomorrow. This SBS on the Money podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and it does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision.
This SBS on the Money podcast is provided for informational purposes only. Content on this podcast should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision.